Just curious. Anybody here doesn't think Gil Hodges should be in the Hall of Fame?
And for those of you listening, there were no hands went up.
Preaching to the converted.
Well, that was Danny Perry, and we are live in the Bergino Baseball Clubhouse at 67 East 11th Street in the landmark cast iron building, Greenwich Village, City of New York. We will start tonight as we always do. To those of you who are here for the first time, welcome. To those of you who have been here before, welcome home. And I would first like to welcome home Danny Perry. It's truly an honor to have Danny here for the second time. I take a lot of pride in that and a lot of wonderment in that as well.
It's a lot of wonderment. I've been invited back. Thank you.
Well, the way this happened was Danny, I had no idea Gil Hodges' book was coming out. And a few months ago, Danny contacted me and said, I have this new book coming out. Can I come back to the clubhouse? And no matter who it was about, the answer was going to be yes. But when it was about Gil Hodges, it was capital yes. But the fact that the clubhouse has been here for about 2 years, and I take a lot of pride in the fact that an author such as Danny would ask me if it's okay to come back. And I have great wonderment in the fact that the clubhouse has been here 2 years, and this guy has written two books in that time.
Very tired.
And as they would have said near Ebbets Field, these are not pieces of dreck. These are thoroughly researched, extremely well written. How he does this, I have no idea. But Danny and his writing partner, Tom Clavin, who is not here tonight, were here with Roger Maris, Baseball's Reluctant Hero, 2 years ago. And tonight, the book is Gil Hodges, The Brooklyn Bums, The Miracle Mets, and The Extraordinary Life of a Baseball Legend. And it's truly a pleasure and an honor to welcome you back, Danny.
I'm very happy to be back.
And I think the best way to maybe start is that your last book was about Roger Maris. You've written many books. What made you want to write about this guy, Gil Hodges?
So there's a very foolishly sentimental reason, and I'm sure you'll all agree with me because you'll all have the exact same sentiments. I'm just grateful to a lot of the ball players who made my childhood so great. I'm very protective of them, and I champion them. And when somebody, including the Hall of Fame, says a player wasn't as good as I remembered him, because as you, particularly you other old-timers, remember Gil Hodges as being a great ball player and somebody who was a future Hall of Famer. And now he's considered by many people a very good ball player, and he's not a Hall of Famer. And the reason, the primary reason for writing this book is because baseball history has been distorted. I want to correct it and give Gil Hodges his due. And the greatest thing that I've experienced so far in all the reviews, all the positive reviews, are that there's one line that just keeps being repeated. This book gives Gil Hodges his due. It's over and over again, that line, and that's the ultimate compliment.
Well, it's very true. And before we get into Gil Hodges, the ball player, the manager, his character is such a huge part of this man, this extraordinary man. If you could talk just a little bit about his childhood and then maybe lead us into the Marines and World War II and give us a little bit of his background that way.
Well, he's so associated with Brooklyn that many people forget he was born in Indiana. He was born in a mining town, Princeton, Indiana, in the southwest corner called the Pocket of Indiana. And then he lived there till he was 8 years old, and then he grew up primarily in Petersburg, Indiana, which was a smaller mining town. His father was a miner, like actually Roger Maris's father was a miner and then a railroad man. The interesting thing I find about Gil Hodges and his brother, he had an older brother, Bob, is I compare them to the Frank and Dick Merriwell. They were paragons of virtue and great athletes. And they were guys who were very moral and very honest, and the greatest word of all is had integrity. And this is the way they were as young kids, and this is the way they were as adults. They didn't change at all. Gil Hodges, I say to everybody, the Gil Hodges, the adult, could have been the father to Gil Hodges, the child. The thing that I think he learned in Indiana, which carried over, and you ask about character, is as a small-town kid, he believed, as his father did, in hard work. Now, I said his father was a miner. His father, Gil Hodges, had a statistic for his father. He said he was the most injured miner of all time. So that's what his father. His father had his back broken twice, his leg broken twice. He lost an eye. He had toes amputated. He had black lung, and he never complained. And that was the big thing. So Gil Hodges grew up keeping all his emotions inside. He believed in hard work, doing your job until it's finished, which is a Midwestern trait. And then not complaining and not expecting any reward for what you did. You just did it. When he went to the Marines, I guess the thing he added in to that stuff he always kept in the Marines, it was never be the weak link in a chain. So that meant he had responsibilities, and he would, like everybody else does in the Marines, they all have a job to do. Again, without complaint and without expecting reward, you just do your job and you're a professional. And that characteristic is what carried over to him when he was a ball player. He never complained about anything. He even he was with the Brooklyn Dodgers, which is run by Branch Rickey, who was the cheapest owner of anybody. And Walter O'Malley wasn't much better. And he thought asking for a higher salary or demanding a higher salary was complaining, so he never did. And this is the kind of guy he was. He was just very straight and narrow, never changed. And what you'll find when we write about in the book is that this is what he taught his players to do. And first of all, when he became a manager, he was with the Washington Senators, all these young guys who were professionals and they got money, but they're not professionals in their attitude and in how they played. And he taught them how to be professional. And then he came over to the Mets. We have Art Shamsky here, ladies and gentlemen, who and Art can verify this, I'm sure. It's just a lot of young ball players. There were a few great players on the team, the Tom Seavers and Cleon Jones and Jerry Kuzman and Nolan Ryan, great in the future, and Tug McGraw, great. But basically, as Ron Swoboda told me, we were all just a bunch of guys. They're all a bunch of amateurs. And he made them into professionals. And the professional thing that the primary thing, he taught them how to play great fundamental baseball. But he also, and the players didn't necessarily appreciate this at the time, and they didn't even recognize it at the time. But they all developed great character, which carried on for the rest of their lives. Tom Seaver would tell me how one talk with Gil Hodges in 1968 in his office about being a professional carried on for 20 years. This is what made him a professional, and I think it's what happened with almost all the players, that they, particularly years later, said, hey, he really taught us the right stuff. A lot of who I am is based on what Gil Hodges taught me, and it's that character which started back when he was a little kid, and it never changed. He never changed his focus, and just got reversed. He became the older guy. The players were, some of them thought he was their father figure. Others thought he was just a great manager teaching them how to play ball and how to live life as a professional ball player. But they all learned from him, and they all have gratitude toward him. And a lot of them get really misty-eyed when they talk about him, because they realize now, if they didn't realize then, is what a special experience they had getting to know this guy, that he passed through their lives and just made them what they are in a positive way.
You know, I've seen Tom Seaver interviewed twice in about the last 6 months, and both times...
He cries.
Every time Gil's name comes up, he breaks down.
You know, I think a lot of you saw on television the recent poll where they voted on the best Met players, and then they voted on the best manager, and Davey Johnson got picked over Gil Hodges as the manager. You know, I'm doing this whole book for 2 years about a guy who's underappreciated as a player, and now kind of is underappreciated as a manager, which is what's going on. And what was great is after that vote was announced, they still had a bunch of Mets come on that show, and they were all just said how great Gil Hodges was and how he, you know, I think I agree with them. They say, they make a big case that the only manager in history who won was with a championship team who can be pointed to say, he's the reason we won the championship. I don't know if Art's going to agree, but we'll find out later. But that every button he pushed that year was right. Every decision he made was right, including the platooning. And it's you can't really do that ever with any other example, including Davey Johnson in 1986. You will say the players. The players are the reason they won, and you know he almost lost the World Series, and that was a great team that never won again, which is Davey Johnson. That's Davey Johnson's legacy with the Mets, as he was with a team that should have won about 3 titles and barely won one. But Gil Hodges was with a team in 1969 that should have come out in 3rd or 4th place, and they won the title. They won 100 games, and people say, and they competed after that, and even the 1973 team, which is the year after he died, that was his team that carried on.
Before we step back a little bit, staying with him as a manager, from your research, did you find, were there any, of all the managers that Gil played for or that he was affiliated with, was there one that he really took the most from, or that had a greater influence on him than any other manager?
Well, everybody says it's Walter Alston in general, because they're both really quiet men who barely talked. And, you know, that was the reason people didn't think Gil Hodges could be a manager, is he was known as the quiet man. He barely talked out of his comfort zone, but he was a leader type. And it's just he knew so much about baseball, which Walter Alston really didn't know a lot about baseball. Charlie Gressen, his prior manager, knew a lot more than Walter Alston. And the players, luckily by the time Walter Alston became manager, really knew the game. They were like experts on every facet of the game, including Gil Hodges. I think the major influence on Gil Hodges, and I'm thinking now off the top of my head, I would say Leo DeRocher, but not because of what he taught him, but Gil Hodges realized that other managers were completely thrown off their game managing against Leo DeRocher, because he did manage in the conventional way, and he threw people off. And Hodges felt that other managers would try to outmanage Hodges. This is what they did, and they would fall into his trap. And I think that is what Hodges really took away more than anything from any other manager. And it's really, it's funny, Ron Swoboda told me that in 1969, during the pennant race, they were, of course, going against the Cubs. Those are the two teams battling for the title, and there's one day where in the dugout, Gil Hodges put like this canvas over his head and pretended to be talking to somebody in the stands or something, because he wanted Leo Durocher to see him. And this refers back to 1951 when Leo Durocher was the manager of the Giants, and they were stealing signs from the scoreboard. So this is Gil Hodges pretending to do this because he hated Leo Durocher. He never admitted it. He never admitted he hated anybody. But Joe Pignatano told me secretly, he really didn't like Leo Durocher. But and I think the other manager who influenced him was actually Casey Stengel. Unlike the other Dodger managers, he platooned. And Gil Hodges saw the effectiveness of that, because the Dodgers basically had the same team year after year after year against right-handers, left-handers. Casey Stengel, when they played in the World Series, would platoon his guys and very effectively, the left-hander, right-hander switches. And and Gil Hodges employed that pretty well, particularly well in 1969.
Okay, so now let's step back to the days when he was a ball player before he became a manager with the Brooklyn Dodgers. So you spoke about how he grew up with this. He didn't want to be the weak link in a chain.
Yes.
And the boys of summer, that was one hell of a chain that they had. A lot of great links. Are there any, as you started to do the research, were there any things that you uncovered that surprised you, or as far as how he was as a teammate?
There's a great story. It's a very quick story. He, in 1946, he played 1 year in the minors at Newport News. He, after the season, he was a professional. The next year, he's going to be a rookie with the Brooklyn Dodgers. He goes home. He used to go home every year back to Indiana. He played a softball game with a bunch of kids. Near Petersburg, and this is the story that unfolds. That a bunch of kids saw him. Hey, here's the ultimate ringer. Gil Hodges, professional ball player, is coming back. Let's get him on our softball team. Well, he made an error. He made the mistake, and after the game, this is professional Gil Hodges, who had been to the Marines, who came out, and he sat there after. I can't believe that I lost this game for those kids. I can't believe that. He was completely distraught. And this is what it was. So what would happen over those few years where the Dodgers kept losing to the Yankees or losing to the Phillies in 50 and 51 to the Giants? He'd always blame himself. He had Catholic guilt to begin with. And he had... He himself always felt that he failed. You know, in 1950, everybody who knows baseball knows the Cal Abrams play where he was thrown out at home plate. And so Gil Hodges ended up coming to bat with a man on third base with two men out instead of one man out against the Phillies. And instead of tying the game with a long fly to the right fielder, Del Ennis, who... lost it in the sun, caught it against his chest, but nobody knew about that, told me that. He made the last out, and they didn't win the pennant. So another thing where he just sat in front of his locker, he didn't express, I lost it for my team, but he had the same thing. He goes home, Joan Hodges is there, as usual, with the meal. He walks right past her up the stairs, and that's the last he saw. She saw him until the morning, and it's that kind of thing. Whenever he didn't do well, it really beat him. And being on that Brooklyn Dodger team, there's a lot of that. And there's a lot of anxiety that eventually killed Gil Hodges at the age of 47, I think. You know, it could have been genetic stuff, but it wore him down. He was a chain smoker. He was in the Marines. We don't know exactly what happened in the Marines because he never would speak about it. Even to Carl Furillo, his roommate for 8 years, who was a fellow Marine. So we don't know if he had survivor's guilt, if he suffered trauma. Gil Jr. says something happened. You know, because why did he ever talk about that? In fact, Joan Hodges got a call about 3 years after they were married, and it was from Ross McGowan, the reporter for the New York Times, and he says, Ross McGowan says, Is Gil there? I want to talk to him about his service in the Marines. And she said, no, he's not here. What did you want to know? I think basically he sat behind the desk. That's all he told me. And he said he was calling to find out about all the medals that he had won. You know, that he never expressed any of that. All Gil ever said was that he learned how to, he became a chain smoker in the foxholes. That was his line. That's the only thing he ever said. Stuff went on. And he would smoke incessantly over the years, and Duke Snyder would say hands would be shaking, and he'd sneak cigarettes in the dugout. And there was this was on the Brooklyn Dodgers, and then he would actually go behind the dugout and smoke until he heard somebody call him and say, you're on deck. And it was just, this went on for years and years and years. It was a five-pack guy. He even did cigarette ads, which is a shame. And 1968, he had a heart attack and stopped smoking for a while, but then he started smoking again. So it was all having to do with anxiety and failure. And so we don't know exactly what caused him to have this, but he had all these emotions bottled up inside him. And he never expressed it even to his family or whatever. And his brother was exactly the same, and they both came from the same father. And they all died before they were 60. You know, so.
Well, if we can talk about another guy who went through stress, a different type of stress, that was his teammate. As you can tell, the person who has the greatest showing in the clubhouse now, since it's open, and will always have it, is Jackie Robinson. And if you could just talk a little bit about Gil and Jackie.
One of the things I learned about Jackie, you know, one of the things people probably know, Gil did not sign the petition to bar Jackie Robinson from playing on the Dodgers in 47, which Lou DeRocha threw out, and they eventually traded all those players who signed. But I didn't realize until doing research that Jackie Robinson was on a team at Barnstorm, a Jackie Robinson All-Star team. For 1 year, there were four white players on this team, Bobby Young, Ralph Branca, Al Rosen, and Gil Hodges, who Jackie asked because they had been really close friends all the years. While Pee Wee Reese was on the shortstop, who put his arm around Jackie Robinson in Cincinnati, Gil Hodges is the guy who was breaking up potential fights all along and pulling people off Jackie Robinson and preventing fights by telling people on the way to second to slow down. So they did this barnstorming, and it was actually a failure thing. And Gil Hodges, of course, like Gil Hodges, never talked about his greatest contribution to race issues in baseball. But you know, they went to Birmingham, there was an ordinance there, of course, the Jim Crow laws were in effect, that they couldn't have white and black players on the same team and playing against each other in Birmingham. So Robinson wasn't the guy who coordinated this. The promoter said you have to sit the white guys. So Gil Hodges was one of these guys who sat in the stands. And Jackie Robinson got a lot of flack for this, by the way. And he always regretted that he played the game at all. That's what Rachel Robinson told me. But the funny thing is there was a substitute, a black player substituted for Gil Hodges that came. It was in the dugout, and the police in Birmingham charged into the dugout to arrest who they thought was a white guy, and it was Willie Mays. So it didn't really. They were, as I said, they were a little rednecked and red faced after that.
I think what we're going to do now is we're going to try something a little bit different because we have a packed house tonight. Something tells me there are probably some Brooklyn Dodger fans in the house, and I know there are some Met, the handful of other Met fans that still exist are in the house. So I think what we're going to do, if people could just abide by this, since we do have a very special guest with us as well, that Danny Blue is covering. But if we could just keep the questions to the Brooklyn Dodgers for now, so anybody who has a question about the Brooklyn Dodgers, or anything that relates to that in any way, let's start with that. And then we'll get to the Mets and everything after that. But anything Brooklyn Dodger related, does anyone want to lead off? Or anything non-Mets, let me put it that way.
I'd just be curious to know how many people saw him play as a Brooklyn Dodger. He was as good as he says.
Yeah, he was great.
He was great.
And all the reporters who covered him, you know, saw him day after day. They're his biggest champions. It's just amazing the witnesses to how great this guy was, and they're all ignored, including the players. You know, Willie Mays and Hank Aaron can say how great Gil Hodges was.
Right. And you see Tony Perez.
Well, I think Tony Perez should be in the Hall of Fame,
but
Gil Hodges should be in there also. The thing about Tony Perez, which is interesting, it's not statistics, is he was the unifier on the Reds, the big red machine teams, and that's exactly what Gil Hodges was. Gil Hodges and Pee Wee Reese were the unifiers on the Brooklyn Dodgers, that everybody liked them and respected them on the team. And that's, you know, there's no stat for that, but that's value.
Do you have a theory, or did your research cover any reason why you might think he's not in the Hall of Fame?
There are many reasons that I think. First of all, the main thing is he's underappreciated. I have come to the conclusion that ball players, you know, there's a 5-year wait for ball players, and it always seemed to make sense that you can assess their contributions really well. I think we should get rid of it, because people actually forget how good some of these guys are, especially with new reporters came in. There's a whole influx of new reporters in the 60s, in New York particularly, but all over the country. And what you will find, because of that 5-year wait, if a player also, their career winds down. So Gil Hodges' last great year was 1959. So he had a few years where his career just wound down. So it's like 10 years. 1969 is when he was eligible. It's 10 years between when he stopped being good and the vote. And also Roy Campanella was 1969. And Brooklyn Dodgers as a group were underappreciated, as you find out. This took so long, other than Jackie Robinson, took years for Campanella to go in. He should have gotten in 57, right in the, you know, like Roberto Clemente. And it took Duke Snider, you know, from 1964 to 1980, and Pee Wee Reese until 1984. His last year was 58. So that, and then Jim Palmer told me that the senior committee decided that four players was enough from that team. So Gil Hodges, the fifth guy, the equal of the others.
Do you know any other 8-man team that have four players?
No, but you know what I think of is the Miami Dolphins' no-name defense, and how for years nobody would get in there. It's like the greatest defense of all, and nobody could get in because it was a full team. And then they put in Nick Wanakani finally. But that's a jip. Another reason that is really important is the Los Angeles Dodgers have not retired his uniform. They will not. So in essence, they're saying he's not in our Hall of Fame. So the voters at the Hall of Fame at Cooperstown said, well, he's not in the Dodgers Hall of Fame. Why should we put him in ours? And they have a backward policy where they won't retire a number until their guy's in the Hall of Fame. So it's ridiculous. But they both look to each other, and they justify not putting him in the Hall of Fame. But there's no good reason. You know, you guys remember Home Run Derby, the old 59 show? Well, he went on and beat Willie Mays on Home Run Derby in 1959, and the host, Mark Frost, and he says, there's a seat reserved for both of you in the Hall of Fame. And we say in the book, you know, nobody raised their eyebrows. It was a given Gil Hodges was going to be in the Hall of Fame. But 10 years passed and people forget it was a given. Yes?
You mentioned something about Davey Johnson getting the popular vote now.
Yeah.
I think it just comes to the fact that it's a now world. So Davey Johnson is remembered. Gil Hodges died so long ago already. And I think that's another reason why the Hall of Fame, he just didn't live long enough. So now you have all these new people who are voting who never saw him play.
Yeah, we thought he'd go in this time, particularly because they could combine his managerial career with his playing career, and it didn't matter. It was just
one thing you said about the Dodgers.
Yeah,
they actually retired Lou Gilliam.
He's the only one, and there's no justification why they would do Gilliam other except, you know, at the time there was sympathy for Junior Gilliam, and Hodges was from a different era. It's amazing. In the 1960s, people look back at the Brooklyn Dodgers and said, not the Brooklyn Dodgers again. We have a new era of baseball. And that's like the 19th century now. And that's how they view it. And it's really unfair, which is a reason we wrote the book, you know, to get his name out there.
I know Gil's issue with the senior community, but do you think for the future, it would be more effective if actual Hall of Famers were voting as opposed to the new writers, as opposed to all the writers?
My real theory is writers shouldn't vote on the Hall of Fame. You know, it's like ball players voting on the writers who should go into the Hall of Fame. I think they don't really know. You know, if Joe Morgan and Hank Aaron and Willie Mays say a guy should be in the Hall of Fame, and some 35-year-old writer who never saw him play says no, you know, and it's all politicking. You know, Ron Santo got 15 out of 16 votes. There's nothing Ron Santo did that Gil Hodges didn't do. Nothing, and Gil Hodges did it during pennant races, and he also managed a team to the world title. And you could write history books without Ron Santo's name in there, and you can't do that without including Gil Hodges' name. You know, just the fact that Gil Hodges drove it both runs in the 1955 seventh game of the World Series. You know, it's like Bill Mazeroski's homer, which is the final little thing that got him in. But with Hodges, it's a mystery why Hodges isn't in. And I can't explain how people think.
Yeah, I wonder if you can address Gil's change from catcher to first base instead of being the company man, or to make way for a guy named Campanella.
Yeah, well, he never. He actually got to light catching. He wasn't a catcher. He was an infielder as a kid, and he did a tryout with Branch Rickey and Branch Rickey Jr. in Brooklyn. And Branch Rickey was a former catcher, and he thought this is a guy who's smart enough to be a catcher. He has the strong arm, and he can hit, and he's really just wise to the game beyond his age. And he made him into a catcher, and he told him when he went to the Marines here, you know, take your mitt with you. And he came back, and when Leo DeRocher in 1958, Hodges got more and more catching, and he was becoming the catcher, taking over for Bruce Edwards, who was injured, and Campanella was being held back, and Leo DeRocher kept saying, "I need Campanella, I need Campanella," and he'd tell reporters that, but over here, he'd tell the other reporters, Gil Hodges is going to be the best catcher of all time. He's going to be the best of anybody. And I talked to Joe Pignatano, who became one of the trusted coaches and friends of Gil Hodges. But when he was a rookie in '57, he came to the Brooklyn Dodgers. He was a Brooklyn guy himself, and Gil Hodges taught him how to catch. He still knew how to catch enough, so he's the one who gave him all the instruction. He still was the expert on catching, and Pignatano said he has the best hands I've ever seen of anybody ever playing any position, that he could have been the best catcher ever, like this. Pee Wee Reese told Frank Howard that give Hodges 2 weeks, and he could play any position. He could be a starter in any position on the field. And Howard said, shortstop too? He said, yeah, he could be the shortstop. This guy, yeah, he had remarkable hands, and that's why he was such a great first baseman. He just could gobble up anything, and including the what they say is the low throw from Pee Wee Reese at the end of the World Series in 1955. So fast, you can't tell if it's low or not. Even I've slowed that down, and I can't tell. But his hands are fast.
What were his numbers like in the World Series? Also, one other thing, I did read somewhere, it's interesting you mentioned about Platooning, because I read somewhere that he was incredible hitter versus lefty. He's obviously great hitter against both, but I heard he was especially great against lefty pitchers himself.
Well, the problem with being on that Dodger team is there were so many right-handed hitters that there were very few left-handers who pitch against the Dodgers, especially at Ebbets Field, which is why Duke Snider had these incredible stats. He was the one left-hander in the lineup, and he, 5 straight years, he did over 40 homers, and he's the one who benefited. Hodges could really hit left-handers, but including Warren Spahn, who's the best of the lefties there. And one of the interesting things was when he became a Met, Hodges and his career was winding down. He ended up with 370 homers, but his 367th homer was against a lefty for the Dodgers, who was
Sandy Koufax,
and the second time he batted against Koufax, he had a home run. So, he could hit. This guy could hit.
All right. So I think what we're going to do now is we're going to have a little transition. I appreciate the Mets fans' patience, and it's really an honor for me to bring up somebody now who, as a 9-year-old. Named Goldberg, I had this guy named Shamsky who was on this championship team, and it really meant a lot to me then, and it meant a lot to me now that Art's become a friend through the clubhouse. One of the great benefits of having this place is you get to meet people like this and become friends with them, and so I'd like to welcome Art Shamsky to the clubhouse. Yeah, so let's start since Danny's the professional here. Danny can start the interview.
My wife reminded me of the 4 home runs. I don't know how many of you know this, but Art is one of the few people in the history of baseball to hit 4 home runs in a major league game. 4 consecutive at bats hit home runs, and I guess you're the first to hit 3 who didn't start in a game.
That was part of my strange career. Yeah, part of the Cincinnati Reds. In 1966, I hit didn't start a game. Came into the game in the 8th inning in a pitcher-hitter switch and went to right field. Manager changed pitchers. I came to bat in the bottom inning and tied up the game. And then we went into extra innings. I hit 2 in extra innings, and we ended up losing that game. And next day we're rained out, and I don't start this game on Sunday. And then
But why didn't you start? That's my question.
A good question.
Why didn't you start the next?
Because I'm pretty hot now. I'm pretty hot and right-hand pitcher, and it's one of these crazy things that you can't answer. And ended up hitting a pinch hit home run off Vernon Law, who was a pretty good pitcher, and hit 4 in a row. And the most bizarre part of it is that we flew out to California the next day, and I didn't start the game the next day in Los Angeles against, I think Claude Osteen was pitching. But
you got a single here.
I got a single pinch inning.
So you got 5 strikes.
Which was a prelude to being platooned a little bit in 69 with the Mets.
I know one of those homers was against left-hander Billy O'Dell.
Yeah.
So that was a toughie from South Carolina.
It was one of these times in your career where you you go through these things where everything goes right. The ball looked like a beach ball, and there's many times it looked like a little aspirin. But the 4 home runs were such a thrill. I get a lot of questions about that. The bat is on display in Cooperstown and Baseball's Hall of Fame because it was strange the way it all came about and everything. The manager, by the way, was a guy named Dave Bristol, who went on to manage some other teams and that my career in Cincinnati was well, it was a great experience for me. And I heard the name Tony Perez. We were teammates for a while, and Pete Rose. And
another great teammate, Pete Rose.
Yeah, we all, a lot of young, good players came out of it. And when I came over to the Mets, it was a different world because Cincinnati always had pretty good teams. I played with Frank Robinson, and once pinch hit for him, and hit a home run too. So it was a strange scenario of events in my career. But I played for, really, in Cincinnati, I was there at the end of Fred Hutchinson's managerial thing. He was very ill at the time, and I played for Dick Sisler, Don Hefner, and Dave Bristol. So in those years I was there, I played for a lot of managers.
So did Dick Sisler ever mention his home run? Or
no, I never talked that. You know, you never really talked to him.
He broke the Brooklyn Dodger fans' heart in 1950.
Yeah.
Three-run homer.
The experience with the Mets and playing
did,
the field was
when exactly did you come to the Mets?
I came the winter of 1967, the first year was 68, Gil's first year. Okay. Tommy Agee's first year. A lot of guys had come over.
Okay, well, the thing with when Gil Hodges got the job as the manager of the Mets, there was a press conference, and the reporters asked him about the Mets, and he said, "Oh, the Mets have a few good players on them." And they said, "Who? What players are those?" And he couldn't think of any. did he know who you were?
Yeah, he knew who I was, and I spent most of my career in the that part of it was in the National League. Mm-hmm. Gil, of course, was managing over there in Washington before he came over. But I can't take the blame for the Mets' first few years and their experience and history. But
well, Gil always says, you know, people make fun of Marv Thornberry, but Thornberry was playing, and I was on the bench. So he'd gotten much worse. You were in the opening day lineup, Hodges' first lineup, playing left field. Mm-hmm. Swoboda was in right field. At that time, did you know you were going to be platooned?
Didn't know at the time. I was happy to be, in that situation. I think it was in San Francisco against Marichal, if I'm not mistaken. And it was a
heartbreaking loss.
Yeah, Mets, I think, historically, for their first 7 or 8 years, we lost the opening, and they lost the opening game. No, it turned into a scenario of events where Gil decided that he had enough players that he could platoon in 4 or 5 positions. And it was an interesting concept because, in reality, nobody liked it. You know, the reality of it is that you couldn't put up any numbers, and then, you know, back in those days when nobody was making any money, and you tried to go make a few more extra bucks, and there was no agents at the time, you would go in and they said, "Well, you only batted this many times, or you didn't play that day, or you didn't do this," and it really was, you know, not a scenario where you really liked it. But the truth of the matter be that Gil was a terrific manager and got the most out of his players. And
did you know that right away?
No, I don't think so. I think we didn't know we really had a good team until somewhere in the summer.
Tom Seaver has said that he says that the only player in spring training who knew that the Mets were capable of winning a title was Jerry Grody, because he really knew about the pitchers, and that over the course of the season, one player at a time would say, "Hey, I think we can win." And Seaver had one particular game against the Dodgers where there was going to be a play at the plate on a ball to center field, and it went under Willie Davis's glove, and the guy scored. And Seaver says, "I think we're going to win." What about you? Did you have a specific time?
I think my experience in 68, when Gil was just taking over and all these new players came to the team, we were a team that we knew we had good young pitching. And the other thing that I think people forget about is that we had terrific defense, particularly up the middle. Jerry Grody, who, in my estimation, was the best catcher I ever saw or played with or against. And he was a terrific catcher that really never got the credit he deserved. But we had great pitching. We had Harrelson, Boswell, Weiss, and Agee up the middle. But I think what we were as a team in 68 and even in the beginning of 69 is we were a team that we had the pitching and the defense, but we didn't know how to win games. We knew how to lose games. And as Gil became more and more of an integral part of that team. We started to learn how to win games. Mm-hmm. And part of that, and a lot of it, I should say, was Gil's way of making us kind of, not so much in pressure-wise, but making us feel like we needed to play better as players. And it was his strong kind of determination and unspoken words, because Gil did not speak a lot. I bet you in the years I was there, maybe had 3 or 4 conversations with him. He was not a guy that you spoke with a lot, but if you had a problem, you could talk to him and you could go to him. But he was not a guy that really patted you on the back when you did something good, or chastised you in front of players when you did something he didn't like. And if he wanted you to pinch hit, he would get up off his seat and he'd go down and he'd point to you. He wouldn't call your name out.
Mm-hmm.
And I over the period of time, I had admired him and so much respect for him, because he wasn't a guy that said a lot of things. And even in the meetings we had, when there was some meetings, he was very strong-willed. But I think over the year in 68 and then in the beginning of 69, as we went to spring training and realized that this is a no-nonsense person. This is somebody that will not tolerate losing 100 games like the Mets did for so many years. And it's about playing better professionally on the field and acting better off the field and doing all these things you need to do to be a major league player. And I think all of us kind of fed off each other. And when the platooning started, just to answer your question, I think nobody really liked it, you know. And then we got Clendenin to play first base, and it was Clendenin and Cranepool and Boswell, Weiss, and Svoboda and myself, and then third base was Garrett and Ed Charles. And then he even platooned the catcher a little bit with J.C. Martin and Billy, but we accepted it because it was Gil telling us this was the best thing for the team. And then it turned out guys had pretty good years doing it, but it wasn't an easy situation, because I can only give you an example of myself in the playoffs against Atlanta. I had 7 hits in 3 games. And then I don't start the first game of the World Series against Mike Witter. But he has the presence of mind to send me up to pinch hit with the game on the line mm-hmm. in the ninth inning. I unfortunately grounded out to second base. So I have the distinction of making the last out of the only game we lost in the World Series.
Well, one of the things Hodges, part of his managing style, had to do with the Marines, and it was never questioning authority. So I would imagine on the Mets, nobody ever came into...
I didn't.
Except for like Svoboda and Cranepool, and they got in trouble for questioning, why am I not playing? But did you generally realize you can't ask him that?
Well, I was not an outgoing person to begin with. And, mm-hmm. and over my career, I wish I would have been a little bit more vocal, but I don't think I would have really questioned Gil at the time. But Gil was a pretty stern disciplinarian guy. I tell you, he was one of these guys. When I first met him and I shook his hand, his hands came up to my wrist. And he would have some meetings and he would get upset, his veins would start to pop out. And
a lot of people have talked about those veins.
It wasn't about, I'll tell you, if we have a moment, I'll tell you about one meeting we had when this was in 68 and we were not playing very well and he's just getting a feel for the team. And We're making errors and not doing very well. And he has his meeting, and he didn't have a lot of meetings. He was pretty good about not having too many meetings. So we're before a game, and
ball players don't like meetings.
No, not with somebody like him. He was tough, but he's talking to us, and he's saying, "You guys can't run the bases. You can't do this." And he's starting to get his vein is there, and. And he turns around, and there was a row of us. That was the era of the sideburns, you know. And so we're all sitting there. It was myself and Boswell and Rohde and a couple other guys. And he turns to us, and there's a little pause, and he's looking right at us. And I said, "Oh, no. What can this be?" He says, "Not only that," he said, "those sideburns look like shit, too." So I guess that meant we needed to cut them or trim them. But he never said another word after that about that, because we started to win. But he was.
There's a lot of hair stuff in the book, by the way.
Yeah, he was. He was such a tough discipline. You know, the one wonderful thing about that team is we had great coaches, too. We had Rube Walker, who was the pitching coach, and Yogi was our first base coach, and Eddie Yost, the third base coach, and then Joe Pignatano. And Rube was kind of like the conduit who kind of smoothed things over. He had something you wanted to say. You could talk to Rube, and Rube would kind of, you know, either answer you or maybe take it another step further. But he was kind of, really, Rube was the kind of guy that really kind of smoothed things over. And Gil just was led by just being the personality that he was, and you respected him. I don't think I ever saw him get into an argument with a player, and maybe he did. I think everybody that came to that team knew that he was the boss. You know, there was the chain of command, and that was, he was the boss. You know, and I think that he set that from day one, and I think my own personal opinion about it is that the Mets would have won more World Series if Gil would have lived. And you know, when I was listening to you talk about the Hall of Fame, I think Gil passing away at such a young age, you know, really hurt him in a sense, because, like you said, the writers and people, they tend to forget it. And like you, I'm adamantly opposed to the writers. I mean, we could say that's another discussion, but I mean, I
except for me, I could vote.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't like the way it's done. I just,
it's corrupt.
I just think it's a shame that he's not in the Hall of Fame, and I think there's guys in there who shouldn't be, and I don't want to mention any names because I don't want to disrespect them, but I feel like it's so watered down now, and what happens now, it's become such a big event that, God forbid, if there's not somebody going in on that weekend, it's not going to be a successful weekend up in Cooperstown. So,
two more questions, then I'll open it up. Did you know, after Gil's heart attack in 68, did you worry about, players worry about
he
him?
He smoked a lot. He was one of these guys that every inning he would go into that little walkway in the dugout there to get to the locker room and light up, and Rube smoked a lot too. I think Yogi smoked too. I think those guys all smoked. But once he had the heart attack, I remember that he was pitching batting practice in Atlanta,
teaching the knuckleball, throwing the knuckleball. Negroes pitching.
Yeah, he was. I mean, at that young age to have a heart attack and being a strong physical. I mean, you're talking about somebody that if you saw him, he wasn't that tall. Gil was about 5'11", 6 foot. He wasn't real tall, but he was. You would think he was 6'3", and once he had the heart attack, I think all of us thought that it was obviously the smoking, and didn't think much about the genetics, but it was the smoking that really was the problem, we knew that there was some problems there.
Always concerned. And my final question.
We're gonna do something unique. We're gonna have the final question as the first question of part two of the podcast. So. To those of you listening at home, just hold on. Thank you.